All right. First question.
My name is Bert Ely. I'm a banking consultant here in Washington. Hernando de Soto writes quite eloquently about the importance of property rights, specifically in terms of that providing the foundation for using property as a basis for getting collateral, for securing loans and so forth. Be interested in the comments of both speakers, both of whom did an excellent job, I might add, in talking about the extent to which property rights are being strengthened or not in Africa and in South America, and more specifically, the extent to which credit-granting institutions are emerging in those on those two continents because of a strengthening of property rights, and related to that, the strengthening of the enforcement of contracts.
Is this working? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I think Hernando is right on the diagnosis. In other words, he's right to point out that we have a huge property rights deficit in Latin America. If I had to mention one basic problem with the Latin American institutional system, I would say it doesn't adequately protect property rights. It's wrong to say there are no property rights in Latin America. I've often heard free marketeers talk about the developing world as if there were no property rights. There are always property rights in any society because somebody has power and somebody is in a position to secure and guarantee somebody else's, usually their own, property rights. So that's the history of Latin America is not the history of a continent that hasn't had any property rights. It's the history of a continent in which power has allocated property rights in a discriminatory way, in a way that created a two-tier society in which some people, usually a minority, enjoyed full property rights, the security of property rights, and the rest was excluded from that. So I think it's right to point out that that's a huge deficit we have. The big question is, how do you incorporate the rest of society into that secure environment in which property rights are protected? There have been many propositions. One of them was the proposition made by Hernando that property titles be distributed massively on a massive scale to many Latin Americans, and some countries have begun to do that. Peru distributed in the last 15 years more than a million, I think about 1.5 million property titles. And that's something that needs to be commended. It needed to be done. People who have invaded government property that was there, you know, not put to any use for years and years and years because they simply had nowhere else to go and built something on it, created something, but wanted to be absolutely sure that they were able to exercise a property right over that territory, or over that land, were in desperate need of property rights symbolized by property titles. Squatters in Latin America, as you know, are an important part of Latin American society. The urban landscape has changed dramatically in the last 50 years, in large measure due to migration from the countryside to the towns, to the cities, and those people who migrated generally tended to create property out of government property, private property out of government property that was simply being put to no use. So property titles were distributed. Unfortunately, that has not generated the kind of entrepreneurial activity, access to credit, and growth, and economic growth and prosperity that it was supposed to. We were talking before this event with some friends here about exactly why that happened. There are many different reasons. I think one of them is that in order for that policy or measure to take effect, you need to change the entire environment. If it becomes a populist measure, in other words, a candidate who wants to satisfy part of the electorate by, you know, handing out property titles as if they were subsidies or handouts, but doesn't change the environment, doesn't, you know, generate a judicial power that it's in a position to actually enforce those rights, that doesn't generate a climate, political climate, in which people actually trust the government, in which banks actually trust the institution so that if you don't pay back the loan that I'm going to give you using as collateral that property title, I'm going to be able to throw you out of that property. then the system is simply not going to work. Apparently, there have been many studies, and I will finish with this. There's an interesting study by some people at Harvard University in Peru, and apparently what's been happening is that many of the banks simply don't trust the system. They say, well, if the government gave you those titles for political reasons, then if I give you some credit and you don't pay me back, I'm simply not going to be able to exercise foreclosure because the government is going to protect you politically. It's in the government's interest to do so. I don't trust the judiciary. I don't trust the government. And therefore, why should I give you credit? Those titles are a political instrument, a populist instrument. So it's a terrible and tragic irony that a measure that was dictated by the grandest of motives and a deep, profound historical necessity has turned into a populist measure. Which doesn't mean we shouldn't be distributing titles and securing people's property rights. It just means we need to change the entire environment so that those property rights actually mean something.
Do you want to comment on Africa?
Yeah, I think I serve as a consultant to Hernando de Soto, and I congratulated him for his breakthrough book on the breakthrough book that he wrote about informals. You see, the thing is, you know, in Africa, you can take any African economy and break it up into three sections. You have the modern sector, which is the abode of the elites. And then you have the informal sector, and then you have the rural or the traditional sector. The vast majority of the African people live in the informal and the rural sectors. You can develop Africa by ignoring those two sectors. But that is precisely what we, the elites, did. Okay, if you look at Africa's development, for example, more than 80% of Africa's development was focused on the modern sector. The modern sector is where you have it's the seat of government and the ruling elites. So that's where a lot of the development aid or resources were channeled. But the modern sector right now is dysfunctional. It is lost. It is collapsing. It's been the source of many of Africa's problems. Now, when Hernando de Soto comes around and writes a book, I mean, as a matter of fact, the informal sector constitutes something like 80 to 90% of the economies of Nigeria and Ghana. The informal sector is alive. It's bustling with a lot of entrepreneurship and economic activity. Hernando de Soto hit the nail right on the head when he says, that, well, look, you don't have property rights in the informal sector, so we should hand out titles, et cetera, will enable the poor to obtain loans from their banks. What I told Hernando de Soto was that, look, the ruling elites are not going to do that. They wouldn't. Because, you see, if you hand titles to the poor, you're empowering them, and they'll become a political threat. So you have to find a way by which you can empower the poor without going through the ruling elites. The government won't do it. And that's why there's been very little progress as far as, you know, securing the property rights of the poor. One of the ways by which you can do this, for example, let me give you a quick example, which is something which I myself am doing. Anybody who has gone to Africa will see that in any African country, you see food vendors. They are selling goods by the roadside. Okay? Let's suppose I take a little bit of capital, I'll call it meso capital, and build a market and put stalls in it, and bring these food vendors into the stores, okay, and I charge them rent. We have a business going. And me, as a, you know, we have, let's say, a market. That market becomes a property. I can take property titles to that particular market. Now, I can use that property to go to a bank to get out a loan and give out microcredit loans to those food vendors who are in there. So in a way, indirectly, there's a way by which you can bypass these ruling governments and establish small little property rights to these food vendors. So you can do it, but not through the governments.
All right, next question. Okay.
Hi, I'm Bob Lerman, American U and Urban Institute. I am not a development expert, but I recall that there was something called the Washington Consensus. And this Washington Consensus, I had thought, did include at least the issue of property rights, the issues of markets, and the issues of macro stability. Can you say how your thinking, I mean, any of you, starting with you, Ben, differs from that consensus. I'm told that people have lost faith in the consensus, so maybe you just haven't lost faith with it, or maybe there are things you take issue with it.
Yeah, I don't think the Washington consensus is nearly thorough enough in its respect for property rights and economic freedom, and often the emphasis on macro stability and government management of the economy at the macro level, at getting that stable as opposed to actually empowering and creating local property rights for the individuals on the ground there. I think often the lip service is paid to property rights and economic freedoms, but when you actually look at what's being done there for change, is very little. I don't know if you want to comment specifically on your regions and the Washington consensus.
In the case of Latin America, I mean, you're right. There's a backlash against the Washington consensus, but the problem is it's a backlash for the wrong reasons. People think it went too far down that path, the market path. And our contention is it just didn't. It's not true. It was much more a corrective measure, actually trying to correct many of the mistakes made by the same multilateral bodies, by the way. I mean, they used to, in the 1980s, say to Latin Americans, instead of, you know, cut down public spending, actually create new taxes so that you can generate more government revenue, so that you can actually make up for the amount of spending that's actually increasing. Of course, what you needed to do was exactly the opposite, reduce the size of government. However, it's very hard to put this point across to Latin Americans today because of the current environment. Again, I say we're going through a booming period in which it looks as if we're growing, we're reducing poverty. We have a growing middle class in Latin America, and for the first time, it's not, by the way, a middle class that's linked to the state, as in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Back then, it was mostly a sort of managerial class linked to the state. Now, we have a middle class, it's small, but it's growing, linked to the market, small businesses, mid-sized businesses, providing services to big corporations. So it looks as if things are going in the right direction. I just think that it's basically sustained by this very positive economic context. Once that has subsided, I think we will see many of the weaknesses and flaws in the system. And I think the answer will not be to go back on some of these reforms, but actually to push forward with them big time. It's very clear. If you go, one by one through these different areas, labor markets, trade, the size of government, institutions, property rights, I mean, the whole thing, you name it. It's very clear to me that the government is intervening too much, the government is crowding out private activity, and that it is very costly and very difficult for somebody who is not already part of the game to actually have access to that participation, to that market. I think that's one of the reasons why the distribution of property titles hasn't quite had the effect that it was supposed to.
Yeah. Bob, the problem with the Washington consensus is that it keeps changing, it has been changing for the past 20 years. Back in the early 1980s, for example, the World Bank and IMF were all preaching economic reform, structural adjustment, for example. They were saying that, you got to roll back the pervasive influence of the government in the economy and give, place more reliance on the private sector or markets, for example. The World Bank spent $25 billion to try and move 29 African countries to this particular type of consensus. What happened? When the World Bank itself came up with its own report in 1994, it said that out of the 29 African adjusting countries, only six of them were successful performers. Six out of 29 gives you a failure rate of 80%. Now, which countries were successful back then? The World Bank named Gambia, Burkina Faso, Ghana, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, and Tanzania as economic success stories. Now, nobody is talking about economic structural adjustment anymore. Okay? Now the focus has shifted. Now we're preaching microcredit finance, and we're also preaching entrepreneurship. So again, you see, this is a typical case of the blind leading the clueless. The World Bank has spent so much money trying to help and reform these, but they don't know what they're doing. Okay, so that's why the consensus keeps changing.
All right. In the interest of time here, we've got one here, one there, and one in the very back there. Why don't we take three questions, and then we'll do three quick answers and see if we can't speed this up. Yeah.
John Perdue from the Fund for American Studies. Question for Alvaro. About around 1990, when your dad was running for president, there was an extemporaneous movement of parceleros that took government land and informally made their own plots, creating a private property system. Whatever happened to that? Has it happened since? Do you?
Well, this would take about a couple of hours. So I have a couple of hours.
How about we get the three questions?
Okay.
Up here. Get
okay.
The three That's questions. We'll question, get the answers. The
Gordon Johnson, retired Center for Privatization. I wonder if you'd comment on George Lodge at the Harvard Business School, emeritus, who made the observation not long ago, economic development is the wrong objective, and economists are really part of the problem, not the solution. The real objective is systemic change, and that's very tough to do because the poor stand to lose the most. They've learned that change hurts them the most. So what do? Governments are not the answer. Governments can't do systemic change, and the best hope, in his mind, is to the multinational corporations. They're the only ones who can create jobs with a future, and that will create then perhaps the internal forces that are needed for change. I wonder if you'd comment on the role of multinational corporations and the potential to harness them or to encourage them or incentivize them to create jobs in the developing arena.
All right, and we got one more question in the back from someone who's vigorously raising their hands, so somebody must have said something very wrong.
R.J. Smith, National Center for Public Policy Research. This is sort of addressed to Professor Aiti. If he would comment on the seeming indifference of the Western nations and the international Greens to the world problem of malaria. The president's over in Africa, and everybody's talking about AIDS, and that's politically correct. You spend billions to fight that. But meanwhile, 2 million people a year are dying of malaria. And half of those are in Africa, and most of those are children. 2 million a year is the equivalent of 5,747s. Fully laden with black, brown, and yellow children crashing into a mountain every year and dying. That's 12 or 13 planes a day. You know, if one 747 crashed a month, the nations of the world would ground all 747s until they found the problem. But because this is 2 million children of color dying quietly in the bush, nobody seems to care because they care more about eagles and falcons. I wonder if you have a comment on that.
All right, you want to do? Let's do quick answers.
Very quickly, the parceleros. Okay, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, you had an interesting group of private haciendas, large estates. For those of you who don't know Spanish, in Peru and other countries, they were very successful. Linked, of course, to the export economy, and as I was saying before, we've gone through these export bonanzas before, and they were part of that. In the 20s, 30s, 40s, and even 50s. But because these haciendas were linked very much to the oligarchic state of the 19th century and even before that to the whole colonial establishment, there was a big, big movement in public opinion against them and in favor of nationalizing them. And that's what the government of Peru did in the 1970s, in the early 70s. They nationalized those estates and they gave them, in theory, to the poor and to the peasants. In practice, of course, to government bureaucrats. Those government bureaucrats, in the name of the people, simply concentrated that property in even fewer hands than they were in before. You had new hacendados, it's just that they were actually government bureaucrats. So what happened? This was a fascinating process. The peasants, the poorest of the poor in Peru, some of which didn't even speak Spanish. I mean, they spoke Quechua, they spoke some of the ethnic languages, started to privatize the land illegally. And they started to parcel out. That's why they were called parceleros, those properties. In a movement of rebellion, a grassroots movement, an up, bottom-up movement of rebellion against the government bureaucrats, and they privatized 60% of the land in Peru. The problem was that those small plots of land, private plots of land, of course, didn't have property titles. Again, they were illegal. They were a very fascinating symptom of rebellion in Latin American society against government action and government power, but they lacked property titles. They lacked the security that would have come along with property titles had this process been done in a legal way. What happened afterwards is what happened with the rest of the economy. It just continued to be part of an illegal environment, which was, yes, private, but, of course, very illegal and therefore very unproductive. That's where agricultural production went down by about 3% every year for the last 20 years or so. So that's basically what happened with Parceleros.
Is Fujimori not trying to support them in some places?
In some places he did, but again, he handed out property titles, but those property titles didn't mean very much to the rest of the institutions in Peru, so they didn't have access to credit. They didn't actually capitalize on those small plots of land. They didn't create economies of scale. So if you travel through the Andes, at least in Peru, what you will see are very small plots of land. People are very proud to own them, but of course those are not economies of scale. So they're still very unproductive. But they represent a big potential. Corporations. I don't tend to think of private enterprise in those terms. I don't think of small businesses, mid-sized businesses, multilateral corporations, foreign businesses, local business. I tend to think of the business world and private enterprise as one big thing. I don't care whether they are small or mid-sized or they're big. If we have the right type of environment, all of them will do their job. Those big corporations will create a lot of wealth, but those small and mid-sized businesses will probably service them and in turn create wealth with them. My contention is that in a country like Mexico, 30% of the resources of every single small and mid-sized business go towards hiring tax accountants and tax specialists to deal with the labyrinthine tax system. If you're a Brazilian entrepreneur, you have to pay 61 different types of taxes. It's a crazy environment in which to do business. You get rid of all of that, and what will you generate is a torrent of entrepreneurial activity, small, mid-sized, and big, local and foreign. And it really doesn't matter whether it is local or foreign, whether it's small, mid-sized, or big. What you will create is a huge amount of entrepreneurial activity that will generate, of course, growth and jobs and therefore prosperity.
Just to clarify a question, it was what he was talking about what outsiders can do. And it's outside governments who can't do things, but outside MNCs coming in to create jobs, which are
The problem is they have to follow the rules that we set. When we had statist environments, those corporations came in and played by those rules. And those rules, of course, were the wrong kinds of rules. That's the problem. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when you had this economic nationalist environment, that didn't mean there was no foreign investment. There was a lot of foreign investment, but of course it played by those rules. You had a lot of imports. Of course, you were able not to import consumer goods, you were able to import capital goods, because the idea was we need to import capital goods, and those capital goods will go towards producing local consumer goods, which were protected. So consumers had to pay a lot more for those products. So they play by the rules. Today they're playing by the rules. These are more flexible, more open rules than in the past, but still in an environment in which a lot of local Latin Americans are still not able to compete with them because accessing those markets is very costly and very difficult. What can they do? I mean, if we open the doors to them to invest, by all means, come and invest. But in the end, the answer is local. As Ben said, it's as little people can do from outside. It has to be a decision-making process that will take place inside. And ultimately, what it's about is what you mentioned, Bauer. I think Bauer, who's probably the greatest development economist of the 20th century, said, in the end, economic development is about what? He said it's about the expansion of choice. That's all it's about. If you generate a free enterprise environment that is an environment which is governed by the principle of equality under the law, what you will have is an expansion of choice. And that choice will of course, comprise everything. Small, mid-sized, big, outsiders, insiders.
All right. George, on the Africa question.
Well, and on the Africa question, also malaria, and also, you know, Gordon, I like to say that, you know, the multinational corporations have been one of those forces which have been most disappointing. They're going into Africa. They don't want to rock the boat, so we can't see them as agents of reform. Look, the West doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. The West should look at how it dealt with the Soviet Union, okay, and communist countries. There, the West didn't go over and hand over money to a communist government on promises of reform. The West helped solidarity groups. Why doesn't the West do the same thing in Africa? Why doesn't the West find these solidarity groups, civil society groups, and help them? Now, you have to be stealthy. You have to be crafty if you want to instigate change. Now, excuse me. To instigate change from within, you need certain institutions, six of them. They are very critical. The first one is an independent and free media. Very, very important. The second one is an independent judiciary for the rule of law. You cannot fight corruption without these two institutions. Corruption has to be exposed. It has to be exposed within the country, not in the West. Now, once you expose it, you prosecute the corrupt for all to see, and then you punish them for all to see. That's where you need an independent judiciary. You don't have an independent media in many African countries. Only 8 African countries have a free and independent media. Only 8 out of 54. So you can't expose many problems in Africa. Number 2, the bench is packed with Mugabe's cronies. So you don't have the rule of law. The third institution that you need is an independent central bank. And then you need an independent electoral commission. You can't have free and fair elections without an independent electoral commission. So, I mean, forget about free and fair elections in Zimbabwe next month. It's not going to happen. And then you also need to have neutral and professional security forces. So, I mean, soldiers or policemen who stand to enforce law and order, not because you belong to the ruling party or you belong to a wrong ethnic group. And then you also need to have an efficient civil service. Give Africans these 6 institutions, and then Africans will do the rest of the job and clean up the continent. By giving Africans this particular type of assistance, this is what I call smart aid. You don't hand money over to governments on promises of reform because they're not going to do it. Now, on the question of malaria, Mr. Smith, I agree with you that it is unnecessary to have 2 million people die of AIDS, especially children under the age of 5. Rest assured, the Free Africa Foundation has been establishing, Free Africa Foundation, which I run, has been establishing malaria-free zones in many African countries. We've established about 13, okay? We go to villages, we talk to the village chiefs. This is right at the grassroots level. We help them craft their own anti-malarial eradication programs. And then we go fumigate the village. We give them insecticide-treated bed nets and also anti-malarial drugs. We've established these malaria, anti-malaria free zones in Ghana, Benin, Nigeria, Kenya, and we plan to expand these. So in other words, you know, there are NGOs like the Free Africa Foundation, which is, you know, doing this sort of work. The tragedy about malaria is that our governments in Africa have done nothing about it. That's where the problem is.
Are you getting any help from the Western governments?
No. We're not approaching Western governments. We're just approaching Western individuals, those in the private sector who are willing to help us. We have our website, freeafrica.org, and we're doing these malaria-free zones.
I think the question raised about how do we get beneficial social change that generates the right institutions in these countries is probably one of the greatest questions that can be asked and one of the most unanswered in social science. It's maybe the most interesting one to explore. Certainly it has the greatest upshot in terms of consequences for parts of the third world and, for that matter, us here. When it comes to the multinationals, I'm not particularly optimistic that they'll have a big part in it. And I think, like a lot of entrepreneurs, they'll respond to whatever incentives they're faced with. They're just as happy to be rent seekers and get money transferred to them from foreign governments as they are our domestic one here. My hope would be more with the indigenous people there, actually, who are already stuck in that country pushing for the change. The good news is when you get the change, the evidence is as a country becomes more free, not only do they get more domestic investment created, but they also get more of the foreign investment in terms of multinationals coming there where it's actually beneficial. So hopefully we'll see more change in that direction. I'd like to thank you all for coming here tonight. Good evening.